Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
And I remember I was crushed at age 13 walking out of the movie theater seeing Return of the Jedi. I saw it with Ernie O'Donnell, Sam Holland, and Ernie's dad. And Ernie and Sam are lightsaber battling as they walk out of the theater with each other. Pew, pew. And I'm somber as an emo kid, you know. And Mr. O'Donnell goes, "Your kids like it?" And Ernie and Sam are like, "Yeah." And he goes, "What about you, Smitty? You like it?" I said, "I loved it." All somber. And he goes, "Why you look so sad?" I was like, "Because that's it. There's never going to be another Star Wars movie." And he goes, "And?" I was like, "What's the point of living?"
This is Sci-Fi 25 Origin Stories, a love letter to science fiction and the fans and creators who made it so, powered by Sci-Fi Wire. I'm Adam Savage, and this episode comes to you from the lair of comic book man, director, writer, and professional Silent Bob impersonator, Kevin Smith. Kevin has spent his career writing and directing films like Clerks, Mallrats, Dogma, Chasing Amy, and Tusk. In addition, he lends his prodigious talents to science fiction franchises like Daredevil, The Green Arrow, Superman, Batman, The Flash, and Supergirl. A fan for life, Kevin even owns his own comic book store, Jay and Silent Bob's Secret Stash, where the podcast Comic Book Men is recorded and shot for Kevin's Smodcast Network. Kevin lives, eats, and breathes this stuff on the daily, and we dissect everything from Star Wars, Star Trek, time travel, Planet of the Apes, and why Kevin sees science fiction as his moral compass. So, true believers, settle in. This one is a whole lot of fun. Here we go. Kevin Smith, thank you so much for inviting us into your home for this podcast.
I'm happy to have you guys here. A, I love you to death. You've given great content to me. I got to give some back to you if I can. But more importantly, like, I literally just got dressed a minute ago. Couldn't have been an easier gig. So
we want to make it easy.
Thank you, for heaven's sakes.
I want to talk about science fiction in general. I know you're a fan. I want to talk about science fiction fandom.
Yeah.
When we were young, fandom was sparse and it was hard to find your people. Mm. But now the internet makes it possible to find your people anywhere, from Belarus to the Philippines.
You'll never be alone again. I remember before the internet, you'd got your hands on any bit of pop culture. We didn't even call it then. Movie stuff. Like, that's what we called it.
Famous Monsters and Fangoria.
Fangoria, Starlog. Yeah. Like, these were our windows. We didn't have the internet. We couldn't do deep dives on subjects we were suddenly passionate about for a moment or whatever. But you could turn to a source. And Starlog was an excellent source. Fangoria was an excellent source. Remember Omni as well, the magazine of science fiction fantasy? That was the kind of stuff, honestly, that probably built the internet. That and pornography, of course. But like the notion that you've got all this wonderful information that you could share that validates you as a person in ways that you couldn't find validation in the day-to-day. For example, when I was young, if you were an athlete, that made you important and stuff like that. And because you could go to college on that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And games in high school are a big important thing. We didn't have a film club or anything like that.
It was also how you identified each other. That currency of knowing those things and meeting someone who could fill in your blank spots and vice versa.
Absolutely. Somebody that, you know, as you sit there and tell a behind the scenes story, they're like, "Oh, well, I heard," and they got another one. And then you're like, there's a like-minded individual. It's tribal. It's how you found your people. And while sports were valid when I was a kid, like loving movies, that wasn't. Comic books? Are you kidding me? That was only if you were a kid. And even then, you shouldn't be reading that sort of stuff. We didn't have cable TV yet. We didn't have the internet. And then they put everything into, you know, the cybernetic unit that's connected to our hand. And it's like, with this, I'll never need humanity again, you know, because this offers so much more humanity in a box. And I don't have to deal with people's actual emotions. So
it's the end of until the end of the world.
Yeah,
they all become addicted to looking at their dreams on little screens. That's precisely what's happening.
Oh, my Lord, it is happening.
How has that changed science fiction as a genre? All the media.
Well, think about it. Now you have a bunch of kids in Los Angeles or New York or Kansas even, are able to watch Nacho's movie Colossal. Fantastic sci-fi movie that's also true to the sci-fi genre because it also tells a very human story beneath it. What are the chances people would have had access to that prior to the internet, prior to us all getting in touch with one another? Yes, you might have heard about it from friends. Like I remember before the internet, somebody being like, you got to watch this movie, Meet the Feebles. It's like Dirty Muppets. And it's made by the guy who did Bad Taste and you'll love this. So it made it easier for us to get in touch with one another. I mean, I don't think I'm stretching here, too, to just be like, what about the creatives? Like, suddenly you can talk to somebody in Salapalo, become friends, like, via some chat room, and collaborate on something. Right. Ooh, here's what the internet did, too, for sci-fi. Gareth Edwards, is that the guy who made Rogue One?
Yeah.
His first movie is Monsters, which is a feature that he shoots and puts up online. He goes to various sites where, you know, a disaster, natural disasters hit. Shoots at his background with his story in the foreground, and then later on adds in some
monsters on his laptop.
Yeah. And that guy then goes on to direct Godzilla for a major studio, and then enters the Star Wars universe and gives us one of the if not the greatest Darth Vader moment in the history of all those movies. That's the power of the internet. Suddenly, it can shine a light on talent you didn't know existed before. Back in the day, we all knew who the talents were. There's George Lucas, and there's Steven Spielberg, and there's Roddenberry, and there, you know, the big names. But now all of a sudden, those names could come from anywhere. You know, anybody could kind of see sci-fi for themselves and add something to it. So I think the internet just kind of made it so we could all find each other, share ideas. Then as the internet got stronger to share media, people are encouraging each other to do things. I remember the first time I saw one of those. They're now proliferate and you can see them anywhere, but shots of the natural world mixed with like Star Wars. So there were scenes of like San Francisco, the San Francisco Bay Area, and somebody put the Death Star in the sky.
I bought one of those prints. They were a limited series of lithographs, and I bought one.
They did it in live like YouTube clip. I remember watching them, and like, you know, I know how the sausage is made. I've seen special effects, and I remember watching this and being like, did they know? You know, is that? No, that's not possible. Somebody must have. No. Like, that's what's possible now. You can create sci-fi. Used to be we had to sit there and ingest it. Here's your book. Read it. Here's your movie. Watch it. Here's your TV show. Watch it. Now you can actually engage with it. You can be the person.
You can do it on your laptop because the cameras are smaller and the digital. The internet has also led fans to feel a greater sense of ownership over the franchises that they love, for better or worse.
Big time.
I mean, I know that you've been on both the positive and the negative end of that.
And that's the idea. Like, you have an audience that's so, like, the ownership to the material is so intense, it supersedes the people that create the stories.
Yeah.
They won't defer to a writer who's coming up with a storyline. They will be like, no, you're wrong. And then you realize these people are fictional, but it doesn't matter.
Right.
Because when you're a fan of something, I grew up, you know, wanting to marry Princess Leia, not Carrie Fisher, Princess Leia and stuff like that. I grew up running around with fake lightsabers in my hand. So I understand the power of believing your stories and not diminishing your stories. Like, my grandmother would watch soap operas, The Young and the Restless, all the time. And, you know, what do you get out of this, Grandma? And then as an adult, I realize I have stories, too. They're just different. It's Walking Dead, Supergirl, Flash. These are my episodics where I'm deeply invested in all the characters. The only difference between my stories and my grandma's stories is, like, you know, in one of my stories, when he wants to solve his problems, the boy runs really fast. And, you know, that's what's different.
But this also leads directly to fan fiction.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, fans taking their own responsibility for the characters that they love. Is this a net good for culture?
Absolutely. I remember desperately wanting to put on a backyard production of Superman. And, you know, my friend Pete King had dark hair. I was like, he'll play Superman and I'll be Lex Luthor if I can get a bald cap and stuff. Wanting to interact with these things you love so much, not being able to. Now you can. Now you can sit there and write fan fiction and you can post it online and you'll find an audience who's like, look, I can't write that. Like, I wish I could write fan fiction about the Twilight characters, so I like what you're doing. Keep it up. And then all of a sudden, like, it changes from, oh, this is to honor something, becomes its own unique thing. So, you know, I'm all for that. I'm all for anything that takes somebody from being an audience member to a creator. The audience will always exist, and you can always remain a part of it. I've been gushing about Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. I shouldn't be as enthusiastic about it, but great is great.
I went and saw it and three times in the theater, and I never do that.
Me as well. Three in the theater. I can't remember the last time I did that. So, you know, I can appreciate on that level still and embrace wholeheartedly, you know, the way I did in childhood. And I think that's why, like, these Marvel movies succeed, as all the comic book movies succeed as well as they do. It's a little bridge back to childhood for some of us, makes us feel kind of young, but they're also just well-told morality tales. At the end of the day, it's like, be good. Being good is better than bad. Being friends with people, you're going to get through. We're all in this together. These are the simple lessons of all these grandiose movies with capes and people with amazing abilities.
I'm curious about what's your earliest science fiction, being captured by science fiction memory.
I guess, I mean, it would have to be Planet of the Apes, right?
Yeah.
Like, because we grew up on the East Coast. And so on ABC, they did the 4:30 movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, that is the sound, Kids of a Happy Childhood. So they would do themed weeks on the 4:30 movie. And they would do Nature Gone Awry week, so they had Food of the Gods, Empire of the Ants, Day of the Locust, stuff like that.
Right.
All those, like, you better treat nature better or else it will eat you one
day. Them, we saw the Day of the Triffids.
Yes, that was, and that rounded up the week. You got it right there. But by the time I was four, so 1974-75, they're starting to do an entire Apes week on 4:30 movies. So you would get all five of the classic movies, well, now classic, but all five of what were then not that old movies.
No, no.
Planet of the Apes, Beneath the Planet of the Apes, Escape from the Planet of the Apes, Conquest of the Planet of the Apes, Battle for the Planet of the Apes. So that was kind of my first introduction to sci-fi, even before I get to Star Wars, before I get to Trek, because Trek was like as inscrutable to me as an Iraqi film, like back then. I didn't know what was going on, the politics of this region. Very talky.
Yeah.
But I would learn to love it later on. Star Wars, of course, you know, it was my first great love. But my, you know, early teenage fumblings, if you will, if I continue to metaphor sci-fi interest into my growing sexuality, I guess, I don't know, fall apart there, would have to be the Apes movies. Because they were kind of about space. I mean, I didn't know that until years later. The 4:30 movie, kids, was started at 4:30, as you might imagine. But the nightly news came on at 6. So this was on a commercial network.
Right.
So
they packed them to pieces.
Right away, you're working at a deficit of 90 minutes. So those Apes movies, you get to be 2 hours already, you're looking at some tough cuts. But mind you, this is network television where they would do commercial breaks. So figure they took out another, at minimum, 10 minutes per act or something. So I saw the world's shortest version of all of those movies. And my Planet of the Apes is different than your Planet of the Apes because it begins with them on the planet. And years later, I got the Laserdisc box set and I'm watching the movies and it starts with them on a rocket. And Charlton Heston is like, am I the modern day Adam? And like doing all the show. I'm like, I must have gotten the Japanese bootleg cuts because I've never seen this shit before. It's insane. And then my friends were like, no, that's the movie, dude. And I'm like, it couldn't be. That's not the one I'm used to. So that was my first intro to sci-fi and the concept of telling a story that can work on more than one level. It wasn't just like, these apes talking, they rule the world. It's a dystopian world. We're upside down. Black is white. White is black. And we're through the funhouse mirror. But they're also telling a story that even as a young child at 74, by the time you get to Conquest of the Planet of the Apes, you know, I was living just a moment after history myself. So
right.
You could kind of recognize even at a young age. Yeah, and if you didn't, you had an older brother to be like, this movie is a metaphor. You know, it's about this. So you're seeing the Planet of the Apes. And of course, just as a kid, you're like, oh my God, there's apes on horsebacks and they got fucking guns and shit like that. All the stuff that would appeal to you as a kid is there. But there's also the seeds for growth, for what would one say at age five? Certainly can't say a social consciousness. But certainly you could recognize there was more. There was a second layer.
There was a morality to it that was very clear.
Yeah, exactly. And as a kid who was raised in the church, you know, you understood the idea of a morality tale. You know, even the sisters who taught us were like, look, David and Goliath, probably not literal. Noah and the flood, probably not literal. These were parables of sorts. So I was already kind of familiar with telling a story on a couple of different levels and how a really great storyteller, you know, does that without you even noticing. And of course, with Planet of the Apes, all those movies, you didn't really notice. You were so wrapped up in the notion of, oh my God, like the whole movie, you're like, we're on a different world. And of course, spoilers, we know the ending is, it's Earth, you know, and it's Earth in the future. And that, even as a kid, like I remember I watched, there was an episode of Mad Men where Don Draper took his kid out to see Planet of the Apes.
That's right.
At the end of the screening, the kid is mind fucked. Like just sitting in this thing, he's going, so that was Earth? And he goes, yeah. And the kid goes, I think it was, he just goes, Jesus Christ. Like, and I remember feeling the same thing as a child when I watched the movie, like, what? You know, that could happen to us if we're not careful. One day it'll be an upside down Arium and apes will rule. So that was my intro to sci-fi. I think my next foray into sci-fi, hardcore sci-fi, would be 76/77, Star Wars happens, yeah, and kind of changes everything.
Okay, so let's talk about some of those early films. Because there's movies that were really important because of when you saw them and what they did. What were your perfect movies from the early days?
I think as a kid, I loved Star Wars, but Empire was a perfect film. Empire Strikes Back. I love that more than Star Wars.
It was such an elaboration and increase of volume of the universe.
And it was also the one that I was early for, whereas Star Wars I was late for. Yeah. I saw Star Wars because other people in class were talking about it.
Me too.
So yeah, it wasn't like, you know, I was ready for it and stuff. Like John Kovic had gotten the early bird kit of figures, the action figures. Oh. But action figures weren't a thing until Kenner had made those little Star Wars figures. And there was something magical about those totems, man. They like really tied together merchandising as a way to market the movie and vice versa. So I saw those figures. What is that? He goes, that's from that movie Star Wars. And I went back to my parents that when I got home from school. I was like, can we go see Star Wars? And if you're good, you get this on your report card. Like, there's always some price. Like, why can't we just go see Star Wars? John Kovic went and he got figures. I'm sure he didn't have to jump through hurdles.
Near you.
Yeah, for the heaven's sake. So we finally go see it, and I loved it, but Empire was my religion. I was ready for it. That was the one where I bought the Time magazine off the newsstand because it had Vader on the cover.
The Vader painted by Leroy Neiman.
Yes, and had all the deep dive information inside, including the plan for 9 films. He talked about, you know, there's going to be 9 Star Wars movies, which made me feel safe as a kid during the Cold War. Because it gave you something to live for. And you're like, there's going to be 9 of these things. So granted, we learned later on that he was like, when Jedi was coming out, he was like, I'm not going to do that anymore. You know, he decided not to make 9 movies. He said it was done with 3. And I remember I was crushed at age 13, walking out of the movie theater, seeing Return of the Jedi. I saw it with Ernie O'Donnell, Sam Holland, Ernie's dad. And Ernie and Sam are lightsaber battling as they walk out of the theater with each other. Pew, pew. And I'm somber as an emo kid, you know. And Mr. O'Donnell goes, your kids like it? And Ernie and Sam are like, yeah. And he goes, what about you, Smitty? You like it? I said, I loved it. All somber. And he goes, why you look so sad? I was like, because that's it. Like, that's the last Star Wars movie that they're going to make. He said he was going to make 9, but then they just recently said he's going to make 3. So there's never going to be another Star Wars movie. And he goes, and? I was like, what's the point of living? And so I was 13, and he wouldn't let me hang out with Ernie for like 2 weeks. He was like, that guy's unsafe. But I just loved Star Wars quite a bit. So Empire was my absolute religion. That was where I not only fell in love with layered storytelling, you can let your heroes lose. And that's a notion that had been implanted in me early as a moviegoer with the Bad News Bears. I think my generation benefited in a way that no generation did after us, that it was fine to lose. There was nothing wrong with losing. Yeah, it sucked, but like, you'll get another chance. And isn't it just fun to play and stuff like that? And generations after that, like raising my kid, you helicopter. There is no loss.
Yeah.
You know, even if the kid loses, like, well, here's a trophy I bought for you anyway, because you are special. Because when Empire Strikes Back ends on such a down note, our generation can handle it. You know, we're like, oh my Lord, well, that happens sometimes, doesn't it? And they won the last Star War, but they lost this Star War, as my dad would say. And then, you know, perhaps the next one they'll win. And as we all know, they did. So everything about that movie, the Wampa scene, taking you to Hoth, the Snowwalkers.
That, again, still one of the, maybe the greatest special effects sequence ever put to film.
As a child, watching the Snowwalkers appear on the horizon as this guy gets his binoculars out, one of the rebel soldiers, and sees something in the distance. And all of a sudden, you're seeing these lumbering metal elephants blasting lasers out of their faces, driven by stormtroopers that don't look like the other stormtroopers.
Yes.
Like, everything about it is perfection. And it's a battle that the rebels lose as well. Like, the Empire does strike back in the first 15 minutes of the movie. They earn the title.
Despite the beautiful circling with the last
heroic moments where battles are won, but the war is ultimately kind of lost. And seeing Darth Vader as the snowtroopers set up the tripod laser and Darth Vader storming through the halls of Hoth, like, This was a guy, last time we saw him, he was the Grand Moff Tarkin's lapdog. Now he seems to be in charge, and he's suddenly way more interested in our hero from the last movie than ever was in the last movie. It wasn't all about, like, I want the son of Skywalker. That was Empire. It just made it so Shakespearean. So it was enrapturing from the first 15 minutes forward and stuff. Then you had the asteroid fields. You had Lando Calrissian, Yoda, Cloud City, the Carbonite Chamber, Boba Fett, the duel between Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker for the first time. Han Solo getting taken away while he's trying to be liberated. Like, all of it is...
The full conversing with R2-D2 in the ship? Yeah.
All of it was, every one of them, my skin still, like, bumps up. Mm-hmm. And not just because, oh, those are warm memories of a happy childhood. Look, I got plenty of those. I was blessed with, like, good parents. But I'm a filmmaker. That shouldn't matter anymore. Because I know how the sausage is made, and I should be able to be like, well, of course, they know how to emotionally push your buttons with things like that. And I was a child. I'm an adult and 47. I could still talk about that and still get chills, still watch that scene and still be blown away, because it has nothing to do with age. That is perfect cinematic storytelling. And, it's sci-fi technically. Now, Star Wars never, Star Wars had all the money, but didn't get the respect that Star Trek did. Star Trek got the respect because they were true sci-fi, and as much as we're working up here with lasers and photons and Scotty, but down here, we're telling you a story about what's happening in the here and now. Star Wars didn't really do that. Star Wars was an adventure story, a story of
a
myth.
Fantasy.
Yeah. But Star Trek works on the level of like, hey, we can take you to space, but this is a human tale. A TV show, while it was readily available everywhere in syndication, never captured my fancy. It was the movies that brought me into it. And maybe it was because it was the promise of something short, as opposed to like, man, these things are long and all they do is talk at each other.
Seasons.
Yeah, I know. I fell in love with the movies and then backtracked into the shows. And I was older at that point.
Did you watch the first movie in the theater? Did
no.
you see Star Trek?
No, and I remember the big sell. Like,
yeah,
I remember,
me too.
Like, it was all about, we're showing you the ship for the first time. In the TV show, the Enterprise was a model, and they had wonderful shots of it. But, they were like, this is a movie. We got to show this off. And there are so many shots of the Enterprise in that first movie. It's just literally 20 minutes of dun, 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 slow tracking shots, dun, 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 and then cut to the other side. Dun, 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 dun. It's just all about the ship. And then later on, they're like, there's a bald chick. So the movie I found later on cable, where I fell deeply in love with Star Trek, was, of course, Wrath of Khan.
That was my first entry.
You don't have to love Star Trek. You don't have to give a flying tribble about Star Trek until you see Wrath of Khan. That's perfect storytelling that works on anybody. You don't even have to know those characters. You need no working familiarity with any of the characters or any of the history. Such a well-told tale. Like, Star Wars had me from the jump because, it was right in my wheelhouse. But Star Trek earned my love, respect, and ongoing interest based on Star Trek II Wrath of Khan. After that, sci-fi started to proliferate.
You get things like Space Hunters.
Adventures in the Forbidden Zone?
Yes! Michael Ironside.
And you would get stuff like Ice Pirates, which was a comedic version.
So I'm always... That's
with
so
Robert
funny
Guillaume.
That those two movies are on the same index card in my head.
We're of the same... cut of the same cloth, my friend. And then the era of the cable TV and the video store brought with it a lot more. There's if you look back over the history of media consumption over the last, 50 years that I've been around, now we're in this period where it's voracious.
Right.
But you could even see back then, once cable happened, like, you got a huge time hole to fill here, man.
And same thing with the video store. There was a sci-fi section, had three movies in it. They needed 50. And all of a sudden you were looking at the cover for DEF CON 4 and thinking,
maybe. Yes, absolutely. And you tried a lot of things because of that. But you'd find wonderful things that are definitely sci-fi, but stretched away from what I would consider traditional Star Trek, Star Wars, even Twilight Zone sci-fi.
Like Boy and His Dog.
Yes, Twilight Zone stuff. Like the original black and white incarnation was readily available to us in heavy syndication on the two channels that we had as Americans. And in the early 80s, they did another revamp of the Twilight Zone. Like Bruce Willis did an episode called Shatter Day right before he broke as David Addison. Where he calls his house one day. He's trying to call someone. He's like, He's at a bar. He's like, oh, I accidentally called my house. And then he answers. And he's like, who is this? He's like, Peter J. Novins. Who's this? He's like, Peter J. Novins. He's like, you can't be. I'm here. And he's like, no, I'm here. And he's like, basically takes over his life. And Peter J. Novins can't go home because Peter J. Novins is fixing the mess that he's made of his life. He becomes a better version of Peter J. Novins. And finally, at the end of it, the replacement Peter J. Novins visits the first guy who's like derelict now in a hotel room. And, you know, tells him, you're not needed anymore. Nobody's going to miss you. And he fades away and dies. It's one of Bruce Willis's finest performances. And I say that as the man who made Cop Out. So you know it means something if I'm saying it. He is wonderful in it. That Twilight Zone iteration I absolutely loved for not just the fact that they did sci-fi so right on a Friday night and stuff. And I guess I'm admitting that I was a geek. Yes, I was home on a Friday night watching the Twilight Zone.
Me too.
But my fond memories of it are watching it with my mother and being the smartest one in the room. So I think episode would end and my mom would be like, what happened? And I'd be like, well, mom, and I could explain it to her and feel hyper intelligent because of it.
That's awesome.
It helps you become a storyteller. I mean, at the end of the day, like, I love this stuff. Like, it is my religion. Let's be honest. It is. It's the new religion. It's replaced my Catholicism. I get my moral barometer from stories about fake people wearing capes. So it works on a lot of people. A generation of kids are growing up on this stuff, and it's not. You know, some people go like, yeah, they're growing up power myths. No, it has nothing to do with power myths. At the end of the day, scrape away these characters' powers. They're human beings. It's how they interact with one another.
Well, and it's a central story of any superhero movie is that the superpower isn't what makes you important. It's your moral.
That's screenwriting 101. I mean, they just read the whole Spider-Man movie. The whole third act is predicated on, I'm taking your costume away because you shouldn't need this to be Spider-Man. And you're like, well, he'd look better in it, but I get what you mean. Like, yeah. It's a good idea. It's a good story. It's a good lesson. So in a world where people aren't getting preached to anymore, they're getting a little bit of morality. They ain't getting religion, but they're getting morality still. And that's all these stories are, man, morality tales.
There are ways in which we understand the world a little better.
And understand ourselves and try to govern ourselves a little bit. And at the end of the day, there's a very slim morality social contract that keeps us all from just kind of devolving into like turning around and slaying each other in our sleep. And I think that has a lot to do with the stories that you're told, or the things that interest you, capture your imagination as a child. If you're not getting some sort of morality whipped on you, like in some faith or something like that, pull it out the flicks. That's what this generation seems to be doing. But it's the stuff you need. Look, nobody goes to church anymore. And I'm not saying we all should, but the good that did come out of that stuff back in the day is a never-ending kind of repeat of, hey, be good. Here's a little story about some guy that was good and it all worked out for him.
Yeah.
Here's a little story about some guy that was bad and it didn't work out for him and now he's in hell. So you don't get that kind of simple morality whipped at you anymore. You get it through this. You get it through the superhero stories. You get it through sci-fi stories. You know, the Black Mirror, probably some of the best science fiction ever created.
100%.
If that don't teach you to be a better person, take your face out of your phone and turn off the TV. I don't know what does. You know how good you got to be to tell people in your fiction, hey, watching TV and watching media and staring at a black mirror is so stupid and bad for you. And we sit there watching the program that tells us that on a black mirror. It's insane.
Before I let you go, it is incumbent on me to run you through a lightning round.
I don't even know if I could do lightning, but I'll try.
Here we go. Death Star 1 or Death Star 2?
Death Star 2. Better looking.
Films or comic books?
Comic books.
You would have said something different when you were 12 years old.
Totally. I would have said films. But now, with the benefit, 47 years in, looking back, I'm trying to think, like, what do you get more out of comic books? Because that's the bridge to films. So, you know, if you go right to films, you skip comics, you're missing something.
Fan fiction or prequels?
Fan fiction. Anything that puts the power into the hands of the audience is a good thing. The audience shouldn't remain the audience forever. The audience should take the stage eventually because the audience will always replicate itself anyway. And even if you're doing it, you remain a part of the audience from time to time. So it's nice to watch. You know this. It's fun to watch. It is way more fun to be the string puller, to be the one telling the story.
Batcave or Fortress of Solitude?
Batcave.
Skeletor or Megatron?
Oh, how interesting. That's post me, but I'll go Skeletor. I think I've never quite understood the transform. I get it. Like cars that turn into things, but
yeah, it's post my.
Wait, so they're alive? They have souls? They're robots. I remember one like spilt oil all over John Turturro in the first one in a very suggestive way. And I was like, so wait, is that bodily fluid? I never quite understood that. But Skeletor, I get.
Civil War or Infinity War?
Civil War.
Vote for Dent or vote for Loki?
Vote for Dent.
He-Man or She-Ra?
He-Man. And that's, wow, that came out fast. I really should have hesitated or something like that. But honestly, neither. Yeah. But if I have to pick one, He-Man.
All right. Lastly, live long and prosper, or may the force be with you.
See, you know, if you'd asked me as a child, naturally, may the force be with you. But like as an adult, live long and prosper works for anybody. You can say that to anybody in the world and they'd be like, thanks. And if they know Trek, they're like, right on, man. They throw up the fingers. Any language as well. May the force be with you. Like that requires a religious belief of some sort. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That's like when my mom used to say to people like, God be with you. And I'm like, Ma, some people aren't into the notion of God, so you might not have wished God. Don't wish God on them. So I feel like I want to say, may the force be with you. But my real answer, I feel like should be live long and prosper. There's a more elegant and truer sentiment to that. It's more about you, whereas may the force be with you is more about like, I hope you're lucky, man. You know, I hope God's on your side. But, you know, live long and prosper is kind of, it's not putting it in the hands of some, the fate of the galaxy. It's almost in your hands. Yeah. I'm going to go with that. Live long and prosper.
I think that's a fantastic
thing. And every Star Wars fan on the planet's like, oh, you let us down. But I'm sorry. It makes more sense at age 47.
Kevin, we could go on for hours, clearly.
Yes.
But I can't thank you enough for having us in your house.
I love talking to you. I always talk to you, Adam.
My thanks, of course, to Kevin Smith and to you for listening to Sci-Fi 25 Origin Stories, powered by Sci-Fi Wire. Be sure to check out our other podcasts with wonderful guests like Rick Baker, Natasha Vita Moore, David X. Cohen, and Jonathan Frakes. For more information about the podcast, please visit us at sci-fi.com.